What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Zach and Pat Show. I'm Zach.
I'm Pat.
This is the show about manhood, fatherhood, entrepreneurship, and the mentality it takes to be successful at those things. And we'll probably sprinkle in some helpful real estate advice, too, because that's what Pat and I do. You know, guys, life can be tough. We can go through some things and struggle at times, but this is the show to let you know that you're not alone. So if you're someone out there going through any of these things, this is the show for you. All right, guys, just some housekeeping first before we get into our awesome guest today. Reminder, we are reading, our book of the month is Winning by Tim Grover. We're reading this one together. And then at the end of the month, we will be doing a podcast all about the book, recapping it, going over our takeaways and, you know, just telling you what we thought about it. So, this one is, I believe that, you know, the sequel or his second book. The first one was more about Michael Jordan. This one seems to be a lot more about Kobe, which is pretty cool. So get the book, read it along with us. We'll be recapping it at the end of the month, so be on the lookout for that episode. Also, shout out to our friends at NeuroGum for keeping us energized and focused. NeuroGum is a chewing gum with caffeine and nootropics in it. Got caffeine, L-theanine, B, E, vitamins 12 and 6. Helps keep you focused. Hey, you know, really gets me through my CrossFit workouts sometimes. I chew it while I'm driving around showing houses. Whenever I need a little pick-me-up, I grab a piece of NeuroGum, you know, because it's, instead of reaching for another energy drink or another cup of coffee, it just kind of gets me where I need to be. So I'm big fan of the NeuroGum.
Shout out to our people over at Fit Flavors. Until the end of this month, we've got our own code, podcast50, which gets you 50% off a one-time gift card online. I went on, bought a $1,000 gift card for $500. I just used the last of it the other day. And I mean, I eat this every day, 2-3 times a day. It's a great for being on the go and eating healthy. So you get to track your macros. It's something you can pop in the microwave real quick for a minute and 30 seconds. It's delicious and it helps you stay on track. So just go online, check it out, give it a shot. Their food's delicious. New menu drops here in June. So if you want to try what's out now, get there as soon as you can.
All right. And to introduce our awesome guest today, he is a commercial real estate agent, a full-time real estate investor, the owner of Green Forest Capital, the creator of the Make It Happen Multifamily Group, the great and powerful Lee Fjord.
Zach, Pat, thanks for having me on.
Welcome.
I'm super excited. It's
we're
be
excited
awesome.
To have you.
Yeah, man. Well, yeah. We're happy to have you here, man. Let's just tell the people a little bit about yourself, kind of give us a little origin story of Lee.
So I was born in Sacramento, California. No, I'm just kidding. We'll fast forward. So
you can start with the born.
Whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I ended up. So one story I'd like to start with is when I was graduating college, I was out for a swim in the water with my stepdad, you know, graduating. He was like, so what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what do you want to be? And I was like, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I want to be a slumlord. And he was like, what? So I walked him through like, no, I want to have, you know, apartments. I want to provide people with housing. And I've done, you know, I've looked into it and that's what I want to do. My favorite class in college was real estate investing. And needless to say, I did not immediately go into real estate. I ended up going through the process of a first job, second job, third job, and eventually got into real estate in 2012.
I'm just curious, what are some of those jobs?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever talked to you about that.
Oh, the first job I had was I sold aviation insurance. So that was right out of college. I got a dual degree in finance and aviation management. So what does finance and aviation equal? Selling insurance to people who own private planes. So
Is there a big market for that?
Oh, that, yes.
Really?
Oh, and the premiums are huge. Huh. So in comparison to like selling insurance at State Farm for sure, like auto or home insurance, the premium on a citation is like $50,000 a year.
Oh, wow. Shit.
And your margin, your profit share is 10%.
Oh, wow.
So every time you sign up or renew an insurance policy with a real estate developer who owns a citation, you're making $5,000 a year on a clip every single time.
Every year?
Every year.
Wow.
Every year. Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful thing.
Okay.
So, my first job was researching and cold calling owners of private planes,
okay.
Which it's public information, you
sure.
know, the, who owns the aircraft. You can find the aircraft based on the, you know, aircraft number. So I would even go to airports and literally just take pictures of airplanes' tails and take right. the number and then look it up in the FAA website, find out who owned it, skip trace the owner's information, find out who it was and give him a call. Hey, you know, I'd love to be able to give you an opportunity to have your insurance, reviewed. I'd like to review your current insurance policy on your private airplane. And it was great.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't sound too bad.
No, it was. Honestly, looking back, I would be twice as successful financially today had I just kept that same job in that same position.
Wow.
Like, I'd have taken over the division, eventually grown, and you know, I'd probably be making more money than I am today. Yeah. If had I just stuck with that one thing and been amazing at that. And it was a great industry. And you get to hang out with the coolest people.
People that own private planes and shit.
Yeah. Like helicopter. One of our best clients was a helicopter tour company based out of Hawaii that flies people into the, into the volcanoes and stuff. Like the coolest people you'd ever want to do business with. It was amazing.
Yeah, damn, volcano coverage. It's probably pretty expensive.
Yeah, each one of those airplane or one of those helicopters was about $1 million. It just in insurance single year. Yeah, every year per aircraft.
Wow. 50 G's for you every year. Then,
every year.
Yes, awesome.
Yeah. And that's at the discounted rate. So yeah, $50,000 a year for the guy who's writing the policy on those.
I mean, that just goes to show you how much money those helicopter rides make if they're able to afford. One, a fleet of helicopters and $1 million on each one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Whoa. Fuck. That's crazy.
Every single one. Yeah. There's a reason why it's whatever it is.
Right.
$500 for a 45-minute flight.
Right.
Like each head. Right.
Right. Right. Damn. Okay. So you did that for a little bit and then.
Then transitioned. One of my clients actually hired me to run the business, a portion of the business development for a radar development company. That sold transportable radars to the U.S. military.
Okay.
So they developed a transportable radar. So it's like truck mounted, trailer mounted. So a truck can pull it onto a site. It can then be connected to a giant, generator system, and it will track and measure the a low observable object flying through the air. So it could track and measure, a
drone.
Stealth drone. Sweet. It's the tool they would use to test and retest and see spin rate and velocity and climb rate and you name it.
Really?
It was pretty cool. So we won a $500 million contract while I was there with that company. And then, 2012 hit. Session was, hitting everybody pretty hard. We also decided to, my spouse at the time decided to move to Destin, Florida, and I looked at Destin and there's really only three ways to be able to make, six figures in Destin, Florida. You can either be a dentist, some sort of a doctor, a lawyer, or you can sell real estate. So I got my real estate license.
Oh yeah.
And I sat open houses at a development project waiting for someone to walk in and, give them tours and say, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Needless to say, that never happened. 2012 was a really difficult time to become a real estate agent. Nobody was buying. Nobody was selling. We were literally at the bottom of the market.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to get loans. And I was a brand new baby agent, and I didn't have any guidance or instruction or a coach or a teammate who was going to teach me exactly how to do it. But I kept showing up. So my broker said, hey, you're still showing up. The guy who's running our property management division is leaving. So do you want to take over 20 houses and run those? So it sounds like money. So did that. 4 years later, I built it up to manage 220 single family houses, which is a total shit show. Like managing 220 roofs, 220.
So these are all single families?
All of them.
Oh.
Or condos. And then the condos were the worst ones because you not only had to know the owner, the leasing, the tenant, but also deal with the HOA. As well. Oof. So, yeah, learned a lot, made a good living doing it, started selling properties to and for my clients. And got inspired by a few of them who were in commercial real estate. And one in particular I sat down with, and he became an inspiration for me. He's an assisted living facility developer based out of Kansas City.
Okay.
We sat down in a few times and essentially mapped out how I can progress in my career into owning real estate. Eventually, we set a step-by-step plan to accumulate 1,000 doors by the time I turned 40 and what it would take in order to get there, including what kind of additional day jobs I would need in order to be able to reach my goal. So we sat down, we've mapped it out, and I'm happy to say that I'll be 40 on May 30th of this year, so in about 2 weeks, and I have 997 doors, apartments that I am an owner of today.
Fucking awesome.
That's awesome.
Well, and you're under contract with a 9-unit.
Yeah, right? And that's not counting the ones that you've bought and sold, so...
Yeah.
You've been over 1,000. So good for you. That's awesome, man. Dude.
I hit the goal. And
how long did that take? So that you said that was 2012 or
2017.
2017 to now. That's awesome.
Till today. Yeah. So in
7 years.
7 years bought and have owned over 1,000 houses and apartments.
Well, it's crazy. Well, and for those of you guys that are out there, and you know, I would consider Lee like one of my mentors, man. I've known Lee pretty much since I got into the real estate industry. His best friend is also one of my best friends, Alex Fairbanks. He was the one who kind of took me under his wing and showed me how to be a real estate agent when I got my license in 2020 or in 2019. But I met Alex at the end of 2019, and Alex took me under my wing. And shortly after meeting Alex is when I met you. Mm-hmm. And when I met you, I mean, I don't exactly remember how many doors you had, but I mean, that was 4 years ago, and you probably had less than 20, if I had to guess.
In the latter part of 2019, yeah, I had just closed on my first decent size apartment complex.
Right. Which was, I remember, the 30 one. Yes.
Yeah. So okay, I would have been at like whatever, 52.
Yes. Yeah. But I think before that, I remember you were like just closed on that one, I think.
Yep.
And you were going through the rehab process, and I was like, holy shit, look at this guy. And then see where you are 4 years from then. And now you're at 50 units then, and now you're at just shy of 1,000. It's, how the fuck did that happen, man?
You know how it happened? Partners.
Yeah.
Having a plan and finding and surrounding myself with the people that I needed in my life in order to reach that goal, and strategically picking the people who I was going to do business with based on them filling my weaknesses. So I hate accounting. I hate bookkeeping. So I went and found, not on my first partner, but eventually I found an amazing partner who is awesome at bookkeeping and accounting. So then I can focus on what I do best, which is find awesome deals, get them closed, and run the ever loving hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So how many partners do you have?
So all in all, I have a small group of partners now today that we consistently do deal after deal. I will say that my number one most important partner is my wife. When Zach and I first met, and I only had those, like, call it 52 units or so on and so forth, shortly thereafter, I met my now wife, Megan.
Mm-hmm.
And she honestly is the reason why I went from 50 to 1,000. If it weren't for her and her support and her help and dedication towards the business, there's no way I would have been able to hit my goal. So the most important thing in anybody's life is, who do you pick as your spouse? And then the second one is, how do you, you know, finding your partners? So I have about half a dozen partners that we bring together to syndicate a given deal. We do source and syndicate our capital from private investors around the country, as, you know, little as $50,000 to as much as, you know, a couple million dollars, to be able to fund the majority of the equity to purchase the apartments that we buy.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And how many are you typically buying and selling within a month or within a year? How do you break those down? So by year, by month, on our side of things, we're always breaking it down per month. Like,
yep,
this is how much we're doing per month.
Ours are more annual
because
they're larger, mm-hmm, and they're fewer and far between. I've only sold 4 properties ever since I moved to St. Louis.
Gotcha.
And that's, you know, duplex of 4 family, right, a 70 unit and a 38 unit.
What about our duplex, dude?
Yep. That was one of them. The duplex. Okay. Yep. Yep. I sold that one. I sold a 4 family, and then I sold a 38 unit and a 70 unit.
Okay.
But everything else is, usually the goal is to own something for a longer period of time in the commercial side of the business. It's, you know, many people approach it as like, oh, I'm going to own this forever. It's like, no, that's really not the way that we approach our business. At least our goal is to jump in, own the property, increase the value as much as humanly possible, and with a strategic business plan, and then eventually trade out of it in a, we'll call it 5 to 10 year horizon. Occasionally you get lucky, or the timing just happens to be right, and it's the perfect time to sell a property or buyer comes along and says, hey, I'll give you a number that you thought that you would sell it for 5 years from now. In which case you have to say yes. You know, you can't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, either that or it's a property that just doesn't make sense to keep within the portfolio anymore. So, for example, Zach listed and sold a duplex for me 2 years ago. It was my very first investment property here in St. Louis. I bought it for $37,000. I put $100,000 into it. I was a classic burr. I burred my money out. I didn't make a single dollar on it for 4 years. And then I sold it. Zach sold it for me. Sold it for, I think it was $240,000.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And so six-figure payday.
Yeah.
And took that, all of the equity and the profit from that, and rolled it into my next deal that I bought as a syndication, invested as a limited partner in my own deal.
Now, is that similar, like, commercial wise? Is that, like, on our side, it's called a 1031 exchange. Is it the same thing on the commercial side, or?
Yes.
Okay. So you're just basically kicking, for people that don't know, 1031 exchange is when you own investment properties, you take the money and you buy a like kind property and take the funds from that one and roll it into the next one. You're basically kicking your tax burden down the road until you are ready to pay, basically sell and pay that.
Or die.
Yeah. Or die. Yeah. And so is that similar? Is that a similar concept, or is it the same thing on the commercial side?
It is. So okay. I have 1031, and then I have also sold and then taken the depreciation on the future purchase and offset the majority of my gains from the prior purchase.
Gotcha.
So essentially I do pay the taxes, but because of the depreciation on the new acquisition is very close to enough for me to not have to pay the vast majority of the taxes on the sale of that property. It made a lot of sense to do that. So on the duplex, I sold it and then I invested the capital into my next syndication, and the depreciation that I took from that larger deal was more than enough to be able to offset all of the gains that I had on it. So I didn't need to do a 1031.
Okay.
But when we sell that property, I will not be able to 1031 out, because it's very difficult, if not impossible, to 1031 out of a syndication, because you have to bring all of your partners.
Oh, everybody's got to come together.
Everybody's got to stay in the deal.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really difficult.
You can't
to
just
accomplish.
Take your little portion and use that. Yeah. Everybody's got to do it.
Everybody.
Be collective.
100%.
And I mean, on your, most of your syndication deals, like, how many, I know you, and well, I guess we can get into the differences between limited partners and,
I was going to say, maybe we should jump into it and talk about what the difference between being a syndication or having a syndication versus partners versus.
Sure.
Yeah. So we do multiple types of deals. We'll have deals where it's just my wife and I. Like, we have a 9-unit under contract that we'll acquire with no partners. And then you have a joint venture partnership where you draw up the operating agreement in a way where you divide equity and you divide the effort and written into your operating agreement. And it's split normally as close as possible to the amount of equity that each partner brings to the purchase of the deal. Classic joint venture. Yeah. Like, hey, I'll put
all of my partnerships that I've ever done have been joint ventures.
Yeah. So, yeah. And they're simple to, mm-hmm. understand and build. You don't necessarily need, you don't have to register it with the SEC. It's just a partnership to buy an asset, run a business. Where when you take that to the next level and you start allowing for private passive investors to contribute capital into a deal where they have no control and they have, they have limited rights. You have to register that with the SEC. So there's a step-by-step process. You hire a great lawyer. Shout out to Nick Moore from Atlanta, who's my great lawyer. And we put together a private placement memorandum, which is essentially an operating agreement. It's an operating agreement, but instead of being maybe 5 or 6 pages, it's like 30. And it lays out all of the steps in the process, who's in control, who makes the decisions, what the vote would look like, how many percent you would need in order to make a change, what the business plan is, what the asset is that you're acquiring, where the money is going to go, when does it go to who, how does the split work, which usually there's a, preferred return where the limited partner receives a set amount of return before the general partner or the syndication team earns a single dollar of profit. essentially. So we, ours, the way we structure ours historically has been an 8% preferred return. So if you invest $100,000 into one of our deals, you're going to make $8,000 annually for the hold period of the deal before we make a single dollar. And trust me, we're not in the business of working for free. So, so we have historically been able to beat that by, you know, quite a bit more. My partner's average annual return for his investors after the split has been over 25%. We only have two successful full cycle deals currently right now, and each one was a joint venture. So it doesn't really count, but the total return average annual was 100% of the capital. So 100% annually, you know, so if it was a 2 year hold, you make 200% 2 years on your money.
Yeah, not a bad deal.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Right? Exactly. So at the end of the day, the limited partner contributes capital. The general partner takes that capital, acquires the asset, runs the deal, takes all the risk by signing on the debt, and then executes the business plan, which is the hardest part. The execution is the hardest part, not the acquisition, not raising the capital, not selling the deal, but executing the business plan. And a part of our business plan that's a little bit different than others is, well, let me go back into this. So essentially, the limited partner jumps in, they get an 8% preferred return, and then they take 70% of the profits after that. So my team earns 30% of the profits after 8%. So you already beat the stock market before we even, you know, participate at all. And our objective whenever we purchase a deal is to, you know, the easiest thing to do is to simplify things for anyone. You know, can you say something in 2 seconds or 3 seconds that everybody can understand?
Right.
I'm going to double your money in 5 years in real estate.
Okay.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah. I'm going to double your money in 5 years in real estate.
Give me 100 and I'll give you 200 in 5 years.
Yep. Yeah. Over 5 years. It gets a little bit more complicated because you have like trickles and you get money along the way, you know, and you can take that and reinvest it however you want. So you can accelerate the, you know, your capital that way as well. But, you know, and that doesn't even take into account things like depreciation. So if you have a liquidity event and you need to reduce your tax liability, you can take advantage of the depreciation that we provide by investing into the deal, which will reduce your tax liability in a given year. And therefore, you can increase your returns as well. So which if anybody has K-1 passive gains on a deal, whether it's selling a short-term rental property and they've got $100,000 in gains, the best thing you can do is turn around and reinvest that money and get depreciation and then reduce your tax liability.
Yeah.
You know, if you can reduce that by, you know, down to zero, then, and you normally would have had, you know, 25% gain tax on that 100 grand.
Right.
You take that and you reduce it down to zero and you put 100 grand in. What did you really invest?
100 grand.
You really invested 75.
Yeah.
You really invested 75 because you deferred your $25,000 in taxes that you would have had to pay. So it's an opportunity cost or gain by choosing and allowing for the depreciation to reduce your taxable income. So a lot of complicated things, but the easiest and fastest way to say it is we'll double your money in 5 years. That's our business model. That's what we object to do. That is our plan. Not every plan goes perfectly. You know, like the last two deals we've sold are, you know, we're actually over 100% return, average annual return. So that's a wonderful thing.
Wonderful thing, yeah.
Other investors are having really hard times right now because they invested into deals with floating rate debt, which I know you guys know all about that.
For sure.
And, you know, debt went from 2% to 8% in the last year, which is insane. And nobody could have predicted that. Imagine having a $10 million loan.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you don't even want to think about that. That's exactly what happened and caused the problem of an 08.
Yep.
Now, I mean, on the commercial side, are they like one in one arms, two, three? What are they? Because like now, like, I mean, the lowest we have is a 3-in-1 arm.
Mm-hmm.
So fixed for 3 years, then they'll start. So
yep. Usually it's three. You buy a rate cap usually for 24 to 36 months.
Yeah.
And then when that rate cap expires, it adjusts.
Yeah, and then you're fucked.
And you're
at least in this market we're in right now.
Yeah, and you can go out and buy another rate cap.
Right.
But when you're buying a wider spread, I mean, the cost for it, had you planned to buy one for those next couple years, like, right. Oh, we're going to spend $100,000. Well, imagine when you budgeted for $100,000 rate cap and it's really $800,000. Now I got to do a capital call because we can't sell the property because it's only 80% occupied because we suck at what we do and interest rates are high and cap rates are high. So the property isn't really worth what we think it should be. So what do? Go to your investors and you say, hey,
I need more money.
I need more money in order to keep the property, or we can sell it and you can lose everything. Which would you rather have? You know, which
that's a shitty situation to be in.
Rough phone call.
Yeah. I mean, in that scenario, a lot of investors are actually better off just selling and just losing what they have. Because if you're not with a great operator and if the deal isn't truly going to be successful, you're just throwing good money after bad at that point. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, we've never done floating rate debt. We've never done bridge debt. All of our stuff is fixed, you know, for the entire duration of the whole period.
And that seems just like otherwise you're just gambling.
Yeah. You're hoping and praying that interest rates stay level. And there are a lot of owners right now that are hoping and praying that interest rates go down in order to make up some of the difference. And I'll tell you, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that we're going to remain flat for at least the next year to 2 years.
I don't know how commercial rates work. I know on the residential side, I mean, today we just got great inflation news that is probably going to cause rates to drop 0.25%.
Yep.
Now I don't know how that affects the commercial rate, but I would assume it's kind of something similar.
It ties to the 10-year.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So, and then the Fed, and obviously Fed decisions will highly impact that because you guys deal with a lot on the prime, prime plus or whatever.
Yep.
So that's, I mean, the Fed fund, once they start cutting, I'm sure that'll help. Mm. But that's the thing is they keep kicking that can down the road.
Yep.
I mean, there was talks at one point this year, there was going to be 3 rate cuts. Now, we'll be lucky if we have one. I mean, I think what we've seen in the last, since the beginning of May, with employment numbers and inflation numbers, it might be one of those things where it's like, all right, that probability of a rate cut come in June still might be at like 25 to 30%, but then the next one that comes in like late July or early August, there might be a chance for a rate cut then, if we can see the same reports through that period. But you know, most experts are like, oh yeah, we think rates are going to be back into the fives by the end of next year. And I'm like, oh, that'd be awesome. But
yeah,
from what I'm seeing, it's just, I don't know. I don't know. I would love to see rates in the low, in the mid or in the high fives by the end of next year. If we continue on the trend that we're on with inflation and employment, it could very well happen. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't, especially with it being an election year, who knows?
Let me know when your crystal ball tells you what's going to really happen.
Right, exactly. And, that would be cool.
I'm in. Whatever it says.
Yeah, I think a lot of
It's all speculation, and it's just like, fuck, you know, you don't know.
Yeah.
I just think a lot of that's just like, positive thinking, you know, just trying to kind of will it into existence. Yeah.
I'm doing it all the time. Like, hey, come on, let's go, guys. Let's get these rates better.
Get them lower.
Come on.
You know.
Low inflation numbers. Fuck, it missed.
Yeah. Oh. Yep.
Well, the issue is employment.
Yeah, right now. Yeah.
The problem, and it's a beautiful thing for our economy because there's so many people that are, you know, adding new jobs. It's a beautiful thing, but it's not a good thing for the interest rates at all.
But here's my thing. Like, you look at some of these. So, like, you have the two main ones, ADP, BLS. I tend to focus more on ADP than BLS because ADP actually pulls from the 200 million or 2 million, whatever amount of people, jobs, companies that use ADP as their payroll, where the BLS is just a government survey that they do. And it's weighted and there's all sorts of different things that they can do to manipulate those numbers. So, but like ADP can't, like they're pulling directly from the numbers that they're getting from their software. I don't know if they can go in and manipulate the software, but usually ADP tends to be a little bit more accurate than BLS. But everybody focuses on the BLS jobs report. That's like the gold standard for jobs. And, you know, luckily the last one it missed big time. Mm-hmm. And that greatly helped rates. And when like ADP, like that one, which is, I feel, more accurate, actually showed that there was more jobs created than what was projected for ADP, but it wasn't enough to really swing the market. But
yep,
you're right. What drives me fucking nuts is the weekly jobless claims numbers that we get every week. Statistically, it is impossible for us to have shown 208,000 initial jobless claims every week for like the last 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Like, even like statistically, the amount of people that fuck up filling up the form is like 1,000 people. So there's no way that we should have seen 208,000 people filing for unemployment claims every week for like the last 8 weeks. It's insane that that's how it is. Last week, we people, I guess, started talking about this. And on last week, we finally it went up. 212,000 people filed for unemployment for the first time.
Like, oh, they're paying attention.
Yeah, shit. Guys, right. guys, we got to fucking work on these numbers. We got to really adjust these. So people are fucking watching now. But no, but that's the thing is that fucking number every week fucks things up so bad because they're always like, oh, we're projecting 215,000 people filing for unemployment. And then it comes out at 208. And we're like, well, fuck, there's a miss. Rates are going to go up now. Mm-hmm. Like every fucking week for like the last 8 weeks on Thursdays, that number's come out and it's just been like a skull fuck. And I'm like, oh, you guys, fuck, what's going on here? Let's figure this shit out because it's not right. It's statistically impossible for this to continue to happen.
It's not even off by like enough no, to make no. that big of a difference, like no. at the end of the day.
Right. I mean, but still, but the fact that it's like at least come out with it, like, even if it was like 207,000 or like just change the fucking number because it's looking like you guys are just
forgetting to change it.
Just like, oh yeah, we're just that 208 sounds good. We're just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll just leave that
until someone starts questioning the fact of the probability of this. But yeah, no, I agree right now. Like shit, inflation and that starting from November of 2022, we went from 9% to the number that just came out today, 3.4%. That's a big fucking drop.
Yeah.
And everybody kept preaching like, hey, as inflation comes down, interest rates are going to come down. Guess what? The rates are still the fucking same as they were in November of 2022.
They lag.
Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, it's just like, hey, I mean, we've been seeing the ride. We've been on the fucking roller coaster. But the biggest thing is like we need to get employment information and inflation information on the same page to help rates now, which we've had. And if any, the last 3 weeks are an indicator of that, we could see rates back into the fives if this shit continues. But who knows?
As soon as it starts, it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
for all of us. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Do you do a lot of adjustable rates on your stuff or
no?
No,
I have never done any adjustable rates.
I've never sold an adjustable rate mortgage.
Really?
Never. Everything's been fixed. Everything is fixed.
Yeah. And once you're in, live with your rate. Live with your payment and be happy with
it.
That's what I always tell people. I was like, focus on the payment. Fuck the rate. Because no matter what, like even now, when you're looking at a house, focus on the payment because, all right, even if rates do, let's say they drop 1%. Actually, I just showed this to a woman yesterday. She's like, well, maybe I'm going to wait a year. I'm like, all right, well, that house that you're looking at that's $250,000 now is probably going to be $270,000 next year.
Yep.
And let's say, you know, we're looking at 6.875 today. Let's look at 5.875 in a year from now. Your monthly payment is $20 cheaper versus where we're at now. But guess what? If you buy now and then you refinance to 5.875 based on where you were, your monthly payment now, because of what you've paid into it and what you've bought it for, your monthly payment's now going to be about $1,900. That's a swing of $160 a month.
And you can probably get rid of your PMI too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. And so it's just like, focus on the fucking payment.
Yeah.
Fuck the rate. Rates are what they are. Focus on the payment.
Right. It's like, would you rather get into something and actually own it and, you know, a year from now, or do you just continue to rent for another year and you're missing out on that potential to, you know, buy that debt down every year?
Well, the misconception with that is, I mean,
oh, you're not buying a ton down that first year.
Right. You're not, it's, I mean, interest is front loaded on a mortgage. So your first year, you're really not paying it down all that much. You're just banking on the appreciation to help it grow to where you've got the equity built up. Now, obviously if you put extra money towards your principal balance, which I always encourage people to do.
Yep.
You know, that's especially now, maybe not when they have a 2% interest rate, but like when interest rates are up where they're at. Yeah, I highly encourage people to make one extra principal and interest payment per year towards their principal balance, right? Because that's going to knock about 5 years off your mortgage. So
I'm a firm believer that we are drastically and quickly becoming a nation of renters.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And it's because people want to be the standard everyday W-2 paycheck guy, gal who makes $60,000 a year. They're changing jobs like a millennial these days, or what's the next one? Gen X or Gen Z. Yeah. They will change. Yeah. They'll change jobs for a $2 increase, and they'll pick up and rent a U-Haul and kill their lease or move out on a moment's notice and move town for $2 increase in income and 4 degrees better weather. And
you guys,
they don't want to own a home. They don't want to. They don't. I meet so many of these younger generation folks, and they'll call in a work order for a clogged disposal, and it's like, bro,
Stick your hand down there.
And stick your hand in there and grab that whatever you shoved in there and pull it out.
Grab the spaghetti that you poured down there last night.
They're worthless. And they know they're worthless. They're good at one thing. And it's, I don't know, whatever that one thing is that they're great at. I'm not sure. Yeah. Marketing. I don't know. But the one, like, they don't want to own a home because they don't want to mow the grass. They don't want to have to deal with clogged disposals. They wouldn't know who to call. They think it's really expensive to call a maintenance man or fix things. And they are going to be a nation of renters, which will then increase the divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
Because unlike what our parents lived, their, you know, dream was to pay off their home.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Work hard, you know, for 30 years, have a, you know, enough retirement in their 401k to live soundly and have their home and their cars paid off.
Mm-hmm.
And this now new generation will never have that. They are going to be renters for their entire lives. They're going to be completely worthless as far as like home ownership and maintenance and repairs go. They'll never build equity and they'll just have their savings to live on in the future. And those folks will end up always at the, you know, the lower middle of all. And that lower middle will continue to expand. And the upper, you know, call it top 5% of the nation will continue to grow in net worth.
Well, what was it that came out, like accidentally came out, but was like the government wants us to not own a thing by 2030 or some shit like that? Murph, what do you got on that?
You will own nothing and be happy. Yeah. That's the plight of the World Economic Forum out of
Klaus Schwab.
Yeah, out of chaos comes order. So what you said about being a nation of renters is very, very true. And I mean, I'm not going to go down the whole rabbit hole of, you know, a communist conspiracy, but it is a communist conspiracy. And I mean, if they can take away private property from us, if they can censor us in the dirt, like, or anything else, man, that haves and haves nots, it's always really pretty when they sell it to you. But then when you live it, it's a destitute communist shithole.
I plan on being a very, one of the haves. This is strategic.
I think everybody in this room wants to be a have.
I am going to own real estate and assets across the nation and provide value to my clients and customers. And those clients and customers and tenants will have a wonderful place to live provided by my team and myself. And we will be part of the haves. And it is an honest choice. And that choice comes with sacrifice.
Yeah.
Like, if you aren't willing to sacrifice today in order to be happy tomorrow, you will always be one of the have-nots.
I wonder why do you think like this big, you know, this big shift over the time when we were kids and kind of being raised to kind of where these, you know, Gen Z, Gen X are now, where they're wanting to be the nation of renters. It seems like, man, I'm curious, where is the shift and where did it happen? I mean, I know you probably don't have all the answers, but maybe you have a take on it.
Participation trophies.
Yes,
that is literally part of it.
Yeah,
it literally. Our, you know, the people 1 year old, like one generation old, or Gen X or whatever.
What would you? What are you?
I'm barely a millennial.
Yeah, I'm like on the. I think you're on the end. You're on the top end of the millennial. Yep. I'm on the bottom end of the millennial.
Yeah. Yeah. So at that point, they had TV in their lives.
Uh-huh.
They had their children had iPhones when they were, you know, 10 years old, and nobody mowed their own grass. Nobody went out and painted their own house because they were focused. They're, you know, the new the people entering the working class, their parents were focused on working for tech companies. They did not want, or building a career. They were not interested in mowing their own grass or pressure washing their own driveway or owning a rental property or anything. They're the ones that are going to be successful millionaires who are retiring. And then, but their children won't know how to unclog a disposal because they were busy working 40, 60 hours a week and going on awesome vacations to Mexico. And their children were like, oh man, all I got to do is go get a job.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to get that Google too.
Well, but that's whatever. The thing. I think also the flight away from blue collar work, where once they started pushing college, I think that was a major downfall for them. Like, because people are, I mean, look at some of the fucking stupid shit that they're teaching in college and giving degrees for.
Yeah.
That are fucking completely worthless, putting people in hundreds of thousand dollars in debt and making them fucking useless. Like,
but that's sociology.
Is, right. Like, well, yeah. Or philosophy. Yeah. Like, yeah. Shit like that. Or
go, gender studies.
The only thing you're going to do to that is go be a lawyer. Like, go. Right. And then now you're adding on another $200,000 worth of debt on top of 100%. You after that. So your choices of getting a psychology degree. Okay, cool. Or you can go be a professor. And the amount of those that make or that actually become a true quality, six-figure earning person in society, what do they end up doing?
Yeah.
They go sell real estate.
You're talking to him. I got a psychology degree.
So how much did it cost you to go to college?
Well, when I got out, I had like just shy of $30,000 worth of debt.
But if you include all of your like Pell grants all the other stuff on top of that, probably $100,000.
Probably close to six figures, if right? Not six figures, yeah.
And the cost of like housing.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, I paid 4 years essentially. It was 4 years of, I went to school and I got a degree, but I would say any of the stuff that I learned there, I'm not really utilizing much of that stuff today. I mean, the stuff that I am using that I learned in college, or I didn't really learn in college, is just the relationships that I made with the people there.
Right.
I made a lot of friends.
That's what I was telling my neighbor who was getting ready to go off to college a couple of years ago. I said, I was like, personally, I think college is fucking pointless at this point. Like,
you can learn anything.
Use it to learn how to fucking network. Yep. Because the relationships that you could potentially build in college are going to be some of the best relationships to carry you forward moving on. I was like, if you're going to do one thing, go in thinking that you are going to network and become friends with everyone. Mm-hmm. Get to know everybody. Yep. Because what they teach you is, honestly, you're going to go into the real world and they're going to fucking retrain you anyway to do what they want you to do. So why don't you meet people, become friends with them, network with them, because some of those fuckers are going to be very, very successful.
Yep.
And those are the people. It's, again, it goes back to who you know, not what you know. And that's why, all the cliches, it's not who you know, but what you know, or what you know, but who you know. Your network is your net worth. Like, all of that shit. Like, go and network. Just go and make friends. If you can learn to make friends and network in college, that might be one of the greatest skills that you could possibly come out with.
Totally agree. I mean, I think and I know Lee can talk on this a lot, so this would be a kind of a good segue, but it's all about the people you surround yourself with.
Right.
I wouldn't be where I am today and where I'm going if I wasn't surrounding myself with the people that I have surrounded myself with. I'm very, very selective in the people that I, kind of get close with these days. So, and I know you have a lot to say on that. So what are some of your thoughts?
It took me until I was about 30 to figure that out. Mm. Like, I went through high school and college and, and even into my career life before I realized, oh, wait, now I thankfully did have people in my life that were influential and good quality people who helped me become a good person in my mind and, successful and providing value to the community and society. But I could have done a lot better had I known. I could have, found found people in college who were spending more time working on themselves or their grades than working on how quickly they could bong a beer or beer a bong. I don't know how.
Yeah.
Beer bong a beer. Yeah. or joining the fraternity and having a lot of fun.
Yeah,
that's what I learned a lot about how to have a lot of fun in college.
Yeah. Me too.
I learned finance too. But if I had, instead refocused that energy and either gotten through faster and gotten my finance degree and worked hard at nights and weekends and, gone and like been a teller at the bank or something, as opposed to joining a fraternity, that probably would have been a better path. And, the person getting a psychology degree, it's like, so what are you going to do with that? You're
right.
Going to go learn how to negotiate contracts with people. Guess what? Just go learn
how to do that.
Just do it.
Go just do that. You don't need a psychology degree to do it.
Yeah. Or if, if you're someone who's good, just going to like business administration, it's like, go become a plumber.
Yeah.
Go get your journeyman plumber's license and go to night school to learn how to run a business. And then while you're becoming a plumber, then you can learn how to run a business
right.
while you're making money. and then start your become own plumbing a plumber.
You start your own plumbing company. I
mean, literally.
Yeah. There's so, like, and that's what's crazy is there's so few of those people now.
Oh.
I mean, I know it's shit. Every time a plumber comes out of the house, it's shit. It's like $1,000.
Yeah.
For than like 2 hours of work to come in. And it's just like
$150 an hour.
Yeah.
Just, yeah,
it's insane.
And so, 75 to show up.
Yeah. I was going to say $100 just to pull in your driveway. Yeah. Just to get out of the truck.
Literally.
You know, I mean.
Yeah, the same thing goes for all the trades, whether it's plumbing, electrical, roofing, framing.
Right. Everything. Like anything we have to white import. Collar using your hands.
Oh, yeah. And then people get upset about, you know, us importing our workforce. It's because we don't have the workforce of people who can actually build a house.
Right.
I wouldn't put a framing hammer in the hands of a Gen Z person ever. Mm. Not ever. They wouldn't understand how to do anything. They'd end up like cutting their finger off.
They'd go
the first
take
day.
One swing and tear their rotator cuffs.
Yeah.
This is hard work. I don't know. Oh no, I've used muscles that I've never used before. I'm really sore.
Wow. Like they don't teach them that anymore.
No.
But we have to build houses. We have to install HVAC systems. We have to have that, you know, that workforce. And the only place we're going to be able to get it is from other countries where their parents taught them to work hard.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's it. That's what we have to do. And we have lots of documented workers who they are fully papered and they have visas and they come and they work on site at our projects. At anyone, like right now, we have a deal in Atlanta. We have 25 contractors on site killing the game, and every single one of them is not a born in the United States American citizen. Many of them are already now American citizens because they've gone through the entire decade-long process that it takes to do it.
Forever.
Well, I don't know if you saw the episode, but Uzo, I mean, he talked about this with his family where he's from, was it Nigeria?
Nigeria, yeah.
And I mean, this guy is uber successful, like very, what is he, a
Brown belt
jiu-jitsu, worked for the FBI, now works is high up with a contracting company, and he's looked at as the failure of his family because he's got doctors and lawyers and financial advisors in his, but that's like how his family and the roots, like in the background from Nigeria, like people from Nigeria, how they implant hard work and discipline and all that into him. But I mean, obviously we're looking at him and far from failure by any means.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's what's crazy is like, we don't have that anymore. Again, like I said, I think it goes back to that participation. Yeah, that word. Yeah. And everybody wins. And I like, you're seeing it in schools where like they're, I mean, I just saw something that an A is like 85% to 100%.
What? Yep.
Yeah. A B is like 75% or 70% to 84.99%. A C is like 60 to 75%. A D is like, I don't know, 40 and up. And F is below 40%.
But you know what the diabolical part of that is? Is that they'll tell you it's for equity for some part of critical theory. And for you even noticing that, you're racist now.
Oh, no.
And here's your participation trophy.
Yeah.
Everyone wins, so nobody wins.
Well, fuck it. Yeah. I mean, they're just dumbing down. I mean, that's another part of the developing a nation of owning nothing and renting. And they don't. They're not gonna fucking know.
Are you passing proud of being is 40%.
Yeah.
God.
40%. Not even half.
Yeah, not even 50%
of
the answers need to be correct in order for you to pass the class.
And I'm sure
that's insane.
Well, Gina, what grade does she teach? Or she's in special
ed. She's K through 5 special ed.
Special ed. Okay. So it might be
a little different there.
Like, yeah, I was gonna say, like, because I was hearing, like, you hear things and you read things, and you don't know how true they are online, but like, you get parents that come in and bitch and moan about their kid's grade until the school comes back like, oh, okay, well, we'll change it for Johnny and we'll make it a go. Oh, well, he passed and give him an A. Mm-hmm.
Like, the real question is, like, how many hours did you spend with your kid doing homework or extra work at home?
Right.
Zero. Probably just zero. Throw him in front of the
zero.
iPad.
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah. No.
It's fucking stupid. Like, it's an, I'm scared for the future, especially like my kid's age. I got a 4 or 5 year old. Like,
I'm opportunistic. It's going to be a beautiful thing.
I'm hoping, man. I talked about it on the last episode. I'm teaching my kids to be exceptional, man. I'm going after them, teaching them things and putting it in their brain that they are going to be exceptional men because they're going to work hard. They're going to know what working hard means. They're going to be tough. I mean, shit, bought them boxing gloves so they could fight each other because kids fight. And so I wanted to do them in a safe way. But like, yeah, I mean, they're not going to bully. They're going to stand up to bullies. Like all of the things, like, I'm just like trying to mold these kids into be future fucking leaders.
Yep.
And so that's what I want. It's a shame. Cause like you look at some of these kids that they go to school with and I'm like, what the fuck is going on at these houses?
It all starts at home. Man.
Right.
I mean, yep. you gotta look at the people, you know, and how these kids are being raised and look at the people that are raising them. And, you know, I think that the kids are going to be a direct reflection of the parents. So, I mean,
that's their five people that they're surrounded with. And if you got lazy fuck as parents, odds are that's probably going to be, unfortunately for that person, it's going to take them a little bit of time.
Yeah.
But also the school you're going to put them in is going to have a huge difference.
Oh, absolutely.
These days because unfortunately what in most, and look, I went to public school. This is what it is.
Yep.
A lot of parents by default have to look at the school system that they put their kids in as kind of like a daycare. Because look, you work, you got a house you got to take care of, maintain. It can be hard to sit there and take that time and attention to dedicate to your kid and understand what they're being taught in the classroom. And yes, Pat, I do agree with you. A lot of parents will go in and be like, oh, with my bowl cut haircut, I'm going to tell you how offended I am and how much you need to change your grade. No, it's like you need to take a better interest in your kids' lives. And when you by default put them into the public school system, look, they're going to be roaming around with a lot of free range ideas.
Yep.
A lot of these teachers, and this is no knock on teachers, because guess what? Good teachers help build our middle class. A lot of these teachers are radicalized in public universities where they're told, hey, the system is rigged against you. So when you get this angry person who has a lot of college debt, who believes the system is rigged against them, what are they going to propagate to your children for 8 hours a day for 10 years of their lives?
Yeah.
Go to school, become a robot, and go to work.
School, debt, death.
Yeah. Well, now I think that all started with a lot of it with our generation, because we were coming out of school during the recession and they're like, well, there's no jobs available. So, and now to get a job, you need a master's. Like that was the best fucking marketing strategy for colleges ever.
Yep.
And now you got all these people with master's degrees and have all this massive student debt and they keep pushing that. I'm like, fuck, I got my college degree. And like, honestly, if it wasn't for baseball, I would have just gone and got my associates for free at Merrimack and moved on with my life.
Not to mention our political class likes to shame us and guilt us for things done that we have nothing to do with.
Yep.
I mean, 2012, you were talking about how hard of a time it was to be a real estate agent right then.
Oh,
we also had a political establishment, an administration that said, well, the reason we can't get anything done is because of everyone who's the antithesis of us. It's like, no, it's because your ideas were garbage and they produced a terrible economy and morale of this country was dying ever significantly since. So it's like, you know, if you're propagating that stuff by your elite class, also not good for the youth of tomorrow. That's all I have to say.
I just think it's funny when we're having an issue, government thinks it's a good idea just to throw fucking money at it. Like, that's what's causing our fucking problem. Quit throwing money at shit.
Well, they're printing money and throwing it. You know?
Right, like Biden just came out and was like, I'm going to give you $400 a month if you buy a house and you're this, this, and this. I'm like, we don't need more buyers. Incentivize people to sell their fucking homes. Like, I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, why the fuck do we need to give somebody $400 a month to buy a house? It's fine.
Well, it's been getting worse president by president, too, how much money they print.
Yeah, it's stupid. Stupid. Yeah. And that's part of our inflation problem.
Show up, work hard, you know, build yourself some skills and apply them to to society as best you possibly can.
Yeah, I think we really got away from there on a tangent.
We did.
Yeah,
we
talking about the five people we want to surround ourselves with. So,
yeah.
You
know? Yeah. But no, going to that, like we were talking about this before the show, the power of positive thinking.
Yes.
Let's dive into that. Cause I am wholeheartedly believe in that.
Yep.
Like what you put into the world, the world's going to get back.
Bro, I am too.
And we've talked about it a few times on the show already, but I know that was something specifically that you wanted to dive into. So floor's yours. Let's hear you go off on this one.
Your mindset determines who you are. Who you become. That is literally the most important thing you can focus on, is your thoughts and your mindset. It's not hocus pocus. It's not magic and it's not fake. It is, if you literally focus on the end result, like I am going to get the deal closed. I am going to get the deal closed. I am going to sell 100 houses a year. I sell 100 houses a year. Like what you say speaks it into existence. And the way that works is not like you can say like, I own a private jet. And all of a sudden like magic, poof, a private jet arrives. But if you say and you visualize and you speak into existence that my company will own a private jet because I have to be able to be home for dinner for my children and provide a good life for them while simultaneously running a regional multifamily development and syndication corporation, that's what I will do. And if you are saying to yourselves negative things like I'm not good enough, I am lazy,
I suck.
Yeah.
I hate this. One thing I really correct people when I hear them and I care about them. I don't care, you know, if someone's saying that and I don't care about them, right. I don't fucking yeah. bother. But it's like, oh, I hate this. It's like, bro, you need to change your language.
Right.
Like say this is, you know, this is something I'm gonna overcome. Or say what the result will be. Not right. like I hate when the, you know, toilet overflows in the second floor unit and it, you know, the drywall falls right. in. That's happened 3 times in the last month. And I really hate that. And it's like, yeah, man, just I
love the challenge of getting this toilet fixed yeah, for my client. For the
I make sure to check the toilet every yeah. time that we're walking a unit or turn the water off to the toilet when we're going into the apartment. Like, reframe what you say into right. a positive way and talk about the future in what the way that you want it to be. So that, and the other most important thing I touched on earlier is that it's the first and most important thing you can have is an amazing spouse and a person who has your back. If you have that, you have everything. And if you don't, and you have a spouse who doesn't support you, doesn't believe in you, puts you down, says negative things to you, man, that's a hard hill to climb. And but if you have the opposite, you know, somebody props you up, man, it's gold. You almost can't be
right.
You know, you can't not be successful with right. with a powerful, amazing spouse that has your back. And I thankfully have.
And Megan I'm not going to go into details on my divorce or anything like that, but I do know exactly what you're talking about and how that can translate. So 100% agree with that is having a partner that is there for you, supports you and is lifting you up versus beating you down.
Yep.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I don't know where I'd be without my wife. I mean, we've been together for coming up on 14 years or so. And
you were like 12 when you met your wife.
Well, yeah, dude. Yeah, we just so got lucky. She just sent me the it was 9 years ago today that we graduated college. It's like a picture of us there with our cap and gown. But yeah, I don't know where I'd be without her, man, because, you know, she definitely keeps me grounded at times. Because without her, you know, I always make the joke that I'm like the balloon and she's like the anchor, because like if I didn't have her, I would totally float away because I have like all these great ideas of grandeur, but I don't always plan it out as well as I should.
Yep.
or really think about all the you know, the things that could go bad or go wrong, and she's quick to remind me of that or let me know, and you know, and she totally supports all the crazy stuff I do, which is you know, I do a lot, so it I don't know where I'd be without her, so love you, G.
Yeah. And then the next one is your sphere of influence, the immediate people you spend time with and are influenced by. I have the benefit of being influenced by some really amazing people who have reached extremely high levels of success. And, every time I spend time with them, whether it be in person or we're in a business meeting together, I gain so much from that. And if I enter into a scenario, or an environment where someone is the opposite of that, where they are, instead of a giver, they're a taker, or when they're negative in every situation that they possibly can be, or they're a bully in business, I immediately release them from my life. And I immediately reduce the amount of time I spend around them. And I have had many people in my life that I've had to jettison as quickly as humanly possible away from myself, just in the way that they treat others,
right?
The way that they treat myself, or the way that they treat my business partners, or the way they, you know, it's not in many cases for them, they're not even trying to be, you know, a bully or mean, but it really goes back to it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Absolutely.
And if you are the type of person who is saying it in a way that is absolutely reducing the, you know, the temperature in the room, you're gone. I will not allow you to influence me that way, because I am highly influenced by people that I'm around. I'm a Gemini, and I'm a chameleon. So I'll adapt to my environment. Every time I enter a room, I'll even change the way that I speak. So if I'm like down south in South Carolina visiting my like friends and family, yeah,
start saying y'all.
I'll start bringing out the country and my voice, and I'll start talking to y'all like, "Hey, we're gonna go out on the boat tomorrow. You want to come?"
Yeah,
you know, or I'll be out west in California on a ski trip, spending time with my dad. And next thing you know, I'm wearing a beanie and, you know, and like, you know, and just like, any adage that, you know, the environment that they're talking, or up north, I'll go into New York and I'll speak really fast and I'll go. So I'm a chameleon. And if I surround myself with them, then I'll immediately adapt to who they are. And I can't let that be. So I've had business partners, friends, you know, many other people where it's just like, you got to go. I can't do it. And then literally it's just like shut the door and they don't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then they'll enter every once in a while. And I spend the least amount of time with them, focusing on them or helping them with whatever they want.
Now, this is something I struggle with. Will you, when you do shut that door, is this something you physically, are you say like, "Hey man, we just can't talk anymore." Or do you just kind of just never talk to them again?
I just never talk to them.
Okay.
Literally.
That's my strategy as well.
I don't care about helping them become a better version of themselves at that point. It's just because now I'm putting myself back in that environment with them, you know? And it's just, if somebody asks where to come to me and say, like, never.
Hey, where you been, man? We haven't talked in a while. What's going on?
You're a loser. You're a loser. You know, do things that a loser does. I don't, you know, want to surround myself with people that do the types of things you do, or speak the way that you do, or act the way that you do. So I can't be around you. Or, you know, "Oh, hey, why didn't we get to do business again, you know, for a second time around?" It's, you know, sometimes it literally even comes down to how you spoke to the waitress at the restaurant.
Oh, absolutely. Dude,
that's something that's a trigger for me. Yeah. I spent 10 years in the restaurant industry. And if you're rude to a server, for, you know, especially for no reason, you know, I mean, there's sometimes justified, I would say, but those are really extenuating circumstances. But if you're rude to anybody in the service industry, I'm automatically like, don't like you.
Yeah. Yeah. But they'll like put themselves in a place of
superiority.
Yeah.
Hey, you're waiting on me. Yeah, you know, I'm the boss here.
I'm the boss in this situation.
And it's like look around, dude. The chick's got four. You're one of six tables she's waiting on right now. Yeah. I mean, look, we've got a table of six. There's a table of four. There's three two tops over there. She's got, you know, 15 people that she's chasing around right now. You know, you got to give her a second. She'll be back to refill your iced tea.
Yeah. and then she's got to handle the kitchen.
Yeah.
And deal with the bullshit going on in the kitchen.
Like, 100%.
It's
and you never know what's going on in her life. You know, did she just get into a fight with her husband before she went into work? Is her mom sick? You never know what's going on in someone's life either. You know, so you just can't automatically just treat someone like shit and think that you're, you know, superior to them just because they're waiting on you.
Especially like, and that's what's crazy too, is like, I mean, I'm sure you guys know the service industry and the service that we get has gone to shit. Like it's gotten bad.
Oh yeah.
But even still, like I try to be as polite as I can to these people and they push it. But at the same time, it's like, you know what? We're gonna stay as level headed and kind to this person as possible, even though they are being absolute assholes.
Mm-hmm. That's why you would go into a Taco Bell and you don't even like submit your order to a human being anymore. You just go to a computer. Yeah. I will have six tacos.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're actually, it's not even that they don't want to pay the people to do there. It's like they're afraid to even let them interact with the employee or with the client.
something I don't even think about.
It's like, how many videos do you see get out there with people just going off on fast food restaurants on people?
My favorite are when the fast food people fight back.
Yeah.
Hop over that counter and, and give them the business.
It's a whole different crew at McDonald's after midnight, bro.
Oh, yeah.
They're all packing.
So, one other thing I wanted to get into was, you know, you are the creator of the Make It Happen Multifamily Group. That's when I frequent the tours and pours, I look forward to them every month. How long has that been going on? How'd you get that started? And tell us about it.
It's been 2.5 years since we relaunched Make It Happen Multifamily right at the end of COVID. It has been my passion project for the last couple of years, and I have gained so much value from it, and I put so much time and effort into it. For those of you that are listening, you can find us on Facebook. It's a free Facebook group. Make It Happen Multifamily. And our objective is to create an environment where someone has the opportunity to spend even a small amount of time once a month with someone that has reached a level of success that you want to be. You know, if you remove the barrier of entry, you can accomplish anything. Mm. So for a real estate investor like myself back in 2017 that had my very first duplex, if I had the opportunity to spend time with someone who owned 1,000 doors, and I'd have been there every month, soaking up whatever I possibly
could. Awesome.
Oh, man, some of the people I've met at these, it's just incredible.
Yeah, and if my objective is to curate the environment where someone has the opportunity to do that, that they can actually ask questions, to meet in person, remove the barrier, like, of you know, that is going to be some huge mountain to climb to reach a place where I own 1,000 apartments or whatever your goal happens to be. So we do a monthly live event in St. Louis where we go and tour a multifamily property with the owner, and we learn from him or her about how they bought the property, what they've done since, how did they build their portfolio, where did they get started, where are they at today, where do they want to be tomorrow. And then we do a networking happy hour, you know, type event where we bring them up on stage, and the crowd has an opportunity to ask questions or learn whatever they might want from that individual. One great thing that I'm really excited about now is we're incorporating properties that are actually for sale. So this month, the property, the 48 unit that we're going to be touring, is an off-market property available for sale from the owners. 48 units. It's in an A-class neighborhood of St. Louis, Central West End. The seller completely gut remodeled the whole complex over the course of the last 5 years since he's owned it. And now it's time to trade out of it. And the audience will have the opportunity to ask, you know, strategic questions directly to the seller about the process of, you know, where they've been, as well as pricing guidance and underwriting. And we're going to do a live underwriting of the deal for the crowd, and then they can ask questions about how that process works.
Wow, that's fucking awesome. That is really cool. When is that?
On May 30th, my 40th birthday, actually. Hey. Yeah, on that day, we will be in St. Louis. Come and attend the event. If you can, be there.
You know, I'll be there.
We usually have between, you know, 60 and 100 people in attendance.
It's so crazy because I remember coming to the first ones and it was like me and like four other people.
get me a babysitter.
It's like me, Connor, and like two other people, you know. Like
before COVID, it was, we didn't even do the tours. We just did like a lunch and learn type thing. And yeah, like six people sitting around a table. And then COVID hit. We shut down the in-person events and then relaunched it, started doing tours and pours. That's what we call it.
Tours and pours, baby.
Tours and pours.
That's sweet.
Yeah. And then very cool. We also do a live webinar that is then recorded and posted into the YouTube channel. So people have an opportunity to be able to learn from industry professionals. Like last night, we did our live webinar and we had a tax renegotiation specialist. So if your taxes have increased by 50% for, you know, an unreasonable reason, you can hire them and they will renegotiate that with the municipality.
That's awesome.
In order to try to get your tax bill down.
That's been a big thing over the last couple of years with how homes have appreciated. So very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And we're building something, that we haven't launched yet, but it is going to be a very exclusive, group where you can join and network and be a part of a community with other real estate investors that are doing big things, as well as a major focus on the mindset aspect of the industry, not just learning from some guru that you can buy, you know, 1,000 or 100 unit apartment complex with no money down, just syndicate your very first deal and raise your money from your friends and family. Like, this is going to be actually how it's done. And not just smoke and mirrors and something that you pay like $40,000 to join and then get nothing out of. So stay tuned. Yeah. We'll be launching it here in the coming months. It's going to be something pretty epic.
Dude. Well, let us know. Keep us in the loop.
Absolutely.
We'll promote it and tell all the people. I mean, because obviously, you know, Pat and I know a ton of people in the real estate industry. So we would love to, you know, promote it and get as many people as we can.
We'd like to think the people that are following us along on this are the people that are going to be part of the haves. That would be interested in all that. So
Find a way to surround yourself with the premise of that is finding a way to get into those rooms.
Right.
And those rooms will be virtual and in person, where we'll be doing in-person meetings as well as virtual meetings on a weekly basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing is we talked about it. You're going to be the five people that you surround yourself with. If you're looking to be around five people in that group, is you're probably going to be more than five people to surround yourself with.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anything else you want to chat about before we let you go? Sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, self-promotion, if you're interested in investing passively in multifamily real estate, you can find me at greenforestcapital.com. You can book a call with me and right then and there on the website. And I love meeting people ahead of time. My objective is to meet our investors months and months before we have an opportunity. So don't wait till we have one and we're marketing it to the world. Come and let's get to know each other ahead of time. Let's align and make sure we're a good fit for each other. And then we'll present opportunities to you. In fact, many of our deals are ones that never see the light of day. They only go to our investors that we've already had relationships established ahead of time. Okay. So yeah.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Man. Well, then one more thing. We call it the tombstone game. All right.
All right.
Here lies Lee. What's it say on your tombstone?
Loving father, dedicated husband, and amazing business professional. I don't know, maybe not that, but yeah, loving father, amazing husband.
That's awesome.
Hell of a real estate investor.
Yeah. Yeah. Built a legacy.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Guys, well, shout out to our friends at NeuroGum. So grab some NeuroGum, help keep you energized and focused throughout your days. Shout out to our friends at Fit Flavors. Use promo code podcast50 through the end of May to get 50% off. That's half off, guys, of gift cards through the end of May for Fit Flavors here locally in St. Louis. And remember, we are reading Winning by Tim Grover this month, and we're going to do a recap on that book at the end of the month. So be on the lookout for that. You aren't subscribed yet, please hit that subscribe button, hit that like button, comment what you thought down below, and we will see you next time.